Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, we speak with award-winning author and seafood specialist Paul Greenberg. Paul joins us to share the research he's done on a new book he's writing that examines local and imported seafood. He'll share some startling revelations about Louisiana's shrimp. Then, we'll introduce you to a homegrown shrimp expert, Louis Raines, whose 20-plus years in the business have earned him the name Shrimp Daddy. And this week's Heritage Heroes have their own shrimp tale to tell. It's time to drop the nets and go fishing on this week's Louisiana Eats. New York author Paul Greenberg has a passionate interest in fish. His articles and editorials on the ecological science affecting the world's fisheries often appear in the New York and London Times. His last acclaimed book, Four Fish and the Future of the Last Wild Food, was a delicious read for scientists, fishermen, and culinarians alike, and won a coveted James Beard Award. For the last 2 years, Paul has been working on a new book which examines, among other things, our own Louisiana Gulf fishery. Paul, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thanks, Poppy. It's so great to be here again.
So does the new book have a name yet?
Well, I have a name for it. I'm calling it The Fish Next Door. This book is another struggle, but it's really about local fish versus foreign fish. And right now, 90% of the seafood that we eat is coming from abroad.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest sins in the world. So yep. What are the fisheries that you examine this time?
Well, to begin with, I start where Mark Herlansky left off. He's a big symbol of greatness to me, so I often pick up in his traces. But I look at the New York oyster, but more broadly, I look at the eastern oyster and what has become of it from New York north into New England. That's number one. Number two, I look at Gulf shrimp, or shrimp more broadly, both in Asia and in Louisiana. And then the final thing that I look at is salmon in Alaska. But whereas I looked at salmon in Alaska last time, more or less comparing it to farm salmon, in this case, I'm looking at this pristine, beautiful estuary called Bristol Bay that has the biggest sockeye salmon run in the world, you know, 40, 50 million fish. Mm-hmm. And they're about to put the continent's biggest copper mine right on top. So in each case, what I'm looking at, it's sort of like issue number one is an estuary that's kind of been destroyed, i.e. the Hudson River estuary, and might be coming back to life. Then I look at Greater Louisiana and the Mississippi estuary, an estuary that we know is in trouble. And, you know, but it's still very vibrant, but it's being attacked from multiple fronts. And then finally, I look at an estuary that's pristine, abundant, beautiful, wonderful, and about to get hammered.
You know, this must be such a difficult book to write over this period of time because literally there's elements of changing landscape going on. And covering the eastern oyster, Hurricane Sandy, I know, really affected that. So how did your writing have to evolve around that?
Well, it's funny, you know, sometimes creative nonfiction is truer than life. I remember in an early draft of the book that I turned into my editor, I noted at some point that some climatologists were anticipating a major hurricane in the Northeast to produce massive sea level rises, and that oyster reefs, once protected New York, weren't there anymore, and what we needed was to have them back. And my editor circled hurricane in the Northeast, and she said, really?
Oh, my.
So then in my second draft, Sandy had happened, and I revised it to incorporate Sandy, but probably in my third draft, you know, I'll be another 6 months down the line, and I'll have to, at some point, you know, you got to say, enough is enough.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, the other thing that's going on, the three major stories are all developing. The Louisiana situation is developing markedly because, you know, as you know, BP is in the spotlight again. There's a trial going on.
Yes.
At stake is potentially $20 billion or more.
Wow.
And man, what Louisiana could do with $20 billion to fix its marsh problem.
Yes. Well, that will be an interesting thing that we will all watch unravel.
Yes. Well, say, and then finally with the Pebble Mine story, the one in Alaska, that keeps developing and unfolding. The EPA called for a watershed assessment under the Clean Water Act that would basically ban mining in a fishery of that significance.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the watershed assessment, and it was very, very unfavorable to mining, very pro-fisheries. And it looked like, wow, happy ending. But now they've come back and said they want to revisit the watershed assessment. So, you know, everybody, there's a lot of money involved in this. Anytime there's a lot of money, things get drawn out into an endless soap opera.
Oh, yes. So, Paul, I remember when you first started coming down to Louisiana, preparing to write this book, I remember at one time you were doing a crazy experiment on your own health with Gulf seafood. How did all that fold out?
Well, you know, so I just ate Gulf seafood continuously for a block of time, and then I had my blood tested. And true to form, really nothing was detected. There were no elevated PAHs. But that said, I then went back to a Canadian lab that does toxicology testing.
Mm.
And I had a very funny conversation with them. I said, you know, I'd like to repeat this experiment, but I'd like to do a real full workup, you know, because I feel like I might have missed some toxics that aren't on the normal testing spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And this very nice Canadian man, he said, well, you know, if you're going to do that, you're going to have to dig a little deeper. And I was like, really? And he goes, yeah. I think we might need a flesh sample.
Oh.
I was like, oh, a flesh sample? He goes, yeah, you might need a flesh sample. And I'm like, well, how big a flesh sample are we talking about? He goes, well, you're looking at an inch cubed. Does that sound fun?
Oh, my gosh. The lengths that you will go to for fish science. It's
well, I have to say I demurred at that point. I thought it was good copy just to say an inch cubed. And leave it at that.
Amen.
You know where that inch is coming out of.
Honey, I do.
And the you working wouldn't part of a writer's body, the place he sits.
So shrimp really became your primary focus down here. And
yeah.
You allowed me to preview a draft of your shrimp chapter. And
yep.
I was particularly struck by this quote that Elaine Koritz of the Mangrove Action Project had said in a recent book on shrimp farming. It was an exotic species that destroyed local ecosystems, and it was solely for consumption by overweight people who don't need any more protein or cholesterol in their diet. So anyway, who is Elaine Koritz? What's the Mangrove Action Project? And what do you think about all that?
Well, so she was speaking specifically about farming of shrimp and specifically speaking about shrimp in relation to coastal wetlands in Vietnam, throughout Asia and South America, where shrimp has become this incredibly devastating thing. We've lost something like 3% of the world's mangrove forest globally over the last few years, and a lot of it is due to shrimp farming. So those numbers are pretty generally accepted, and the shrimp farming industry counters and says, you know, they're doing better and better. But I don't know. I mean, you know, it's hard. The interesting thing about Asia versus European or American seafood farmers is that there are just so many of them. There's so many small ones, big ones, diverse ones. And to try and enforce regulation on them is extremely difficult. But, you know, just to back up a second, when I quoted that book, it's a book called Let Them Eat Shrimp, and she quoted in the book. A pretty good book. But I was really referencing the effect of shrimp farming there. Wild shrimp has its problems, but in the chapter that I sent you and in the chapter that will eventually get published, I kind of look at wild shrimp versus farmed shrimp and some of the trade-offs that are involved.
Well, I was fascinated by the story of the Mississippi River shrimp, something that, you know, I don't think I ever had a chance to taste, and one that you described as being, quote, the shrimp that Americans ate, a shrimp that swam right up the middle of our country into the very heart of our national culinary traditions.
Right.
What happened to the river shrimp?
Well, you know, it's funny. First of all, I stumbled upon the river shrimp myself. I was in the Historic New Orleans collection, and it's funny, when you go do a search for shrimp in the Historic New Orleans collection, you get such a funny result. And I came across this book called Delphine, the Little Shrimp Girl, a story intensified by fate's miraculous doings from 1923. And what kind of tipped me off to how common river shrimp were was a line from this little book, and it said, Delphine is this poor river girl, and, you know, she lives in the sort of backwoods, and there's this one line, and she said, the tall, lean father, slow and unresponsive, tired with hard labor in the field, both his own and those of his neighboring planters, pulled his shrimp bags out of the Mississippi River where they had been hanging all night from the levee in the high water to find he had quite a catch. So we're not talking about shrimp trawling or offshore or whatever. This guy just hung some bags in the river and had them full of shrimp.
I had heard stories at one time of people who gathered river shrimp by coating bushes in cornmeal and running them along lines in the Mississippi River. And then they would pick up the bushes and shake them into the boat, and the little shrimp were hiding in there.
That's right. Well, they were quite abundant. What would happen to them, and this was another interesting moment for me, I met a wildlife biologist out of Vicksburg named Paul Hartfield. And Paul is a real specialist in kind of finding endangered species. What he told me is that this shrimp used to migrate from the mouth of the Mississippi all the way up the Ohio River. Now, of course, now there are dams on the Ohio, so they don't get up that far. So that's one thing that blocks them from going up that far and being as productive as they were. The other thing is that those of you down there know, you know, the Mississippi is a very different river than it was when Delphine, the Little Shrimp Girl, was fishing there.
The Army Corps of Engineers helped us again.
Yes, the Army Corps of Engineers did a tremendous intervention on the Mississippi. One of the things they did was to cut off oxbows in the river, straighten the river, and make the river much faster. Well, if you've got this shrimp that has to migrate upriver to Ohio, if the current velocity of the Mississippi changes significantly, how are you going to get up there?
Yeah, they can't swim like that.
They can't get up there. So, you know, just to set the record straight, the Mississippi River shrimp is not extinct. It's probably not even endangered. But as Paul Hartfield said to me, maybe once upon a time there might have been trillions of river shrimp. Now we might have billions or millions. But, you know, it's these orders of magnitude that are always important moments in fisheries, right? You know, with fisheries, people always make the mistake of confusing seafood with land food or sea wildlife with land wildlife. You know, they'll say bluefin tuna is almost extinct. Well, there's still millions of bluefin tuna out there, but there used to be many, many more. What we're talking about is the loss of a food system when things become too rare to the point where they're called commercially extinct.
Paul Greenberg never fails to produce fascinating new information about the seafood scene. We'll return from a short break with more shrimp talk from Paul. He's got some dire warnings about what could be the future of our very own Gulf shrimp. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Award-winning author Paul Greenberg has spent a lot of time in Louisiana over the last 2 years doing investigative research on our local seafood. Earlier, he shared the story of Mississippi River shrimp, and now Paul has some thought-provoking words for us about the future of our Gulf shrimp. Well, one of the most frightening projections that you're making, as far as I'm concerned, is that you believe it is possible that one day we might regard the shrimp in the Gulf of Mexico as so rare and odd as we do river shrimp.
Yeah, so, you know, it could happen. Of course, I'm being a little dramatic for effect, but my author's license. But basically what's happening is, many of your listeners know, we're losing Mississippi marsh at a tremendous rate. I've heard a Manhattan a year recently when I was down with people from the state looking at some of marshland reconstruction, that it's more like a third of a Manhattan a year. But whatever the case, you're losing a lot of marsh. Brown shrimp that you guys love so much rely on the marsh for rearing. They might be spawned out in the Gulf, but then they come inshore. They live in those little nooks and crannies. They depend on the marsh for protection, and also the marsh feeds them, you know, either through decaying organic matter or microorganisms or whatever.
We love those brown shrimp so much, we actually call them Louisiana gold. And they're not as big as the Gulf shrimp, but they do sort of have this golden brown color. And there's nothing sweeter and more delicious than them, are they?
They are so delicious. Well, you know, when I went out shrimping a year or two back, just eating them right out of the trawl, raw, an amazing culinary experience. Anyway, there's an interesting phenomenon going on, which is the marsh is falling apart. And when the marsh falls apart, it creates more edge. Shrimp like the edge, and so they've been doing better as a result of having more edge. But at a certain point, so much marsh goes away that you lose all the edge. And at a certain point, you're going to have a very serious shrimp problem. So, you know, I applaud the state for trying to do what it can. I was just down there working. I'm working on a story right now about the hypoxia zone, you know, the dead zone, so-called dead zone.
Yeah.
And I was traveling around, went down to Sulphur Springs and saw one place where they were actually building marsh by pumping sediment out of the Mississippi into the marsh. And they actually created land. And that's interesting. You know, I'm not a scientist. I can't evaluate the long-term effect of it. What I can tell you is that I remember I was like staring at my iPhone, taking notes, walking around this new ground. And I was like, geez, is this new ground permanent? Is it going to support wildlife and shrimp? And just as I was typing that into my iPhone, I heard a and I looked up, and this giant cottonmouth had his mouth wide open and was about to bite me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I got back.
So it does support wildlife, but it's my understanding that when they create those sort of false islands or barrier islands, unless they plant it properly with mangroves and grasses, it's just going to wash away again anyway.
Well, it's controversial. I know that Eugene Turner and Nancy Rabelais, who've done work around this a little bit, have said that some of this marsh is so nutrient-rich from the silt that's coming off of the Mississippi that it doesn't encourage deep root growth, and so that it can wash away. The state vehemently disagrees with that. They do think that it can be a solution. You know, I don't know. I mean, you got to do something, right?
Well, we're trying. We're trying, but it does seem to be an enormous losing battle.
Well, yeah, we'll see. I mean, again, I point to the $20 billion of BP money that could come down the pike. You can do a lot with $20 billion. I'd rather see you try and figure out something to do with that marsh, or further upstream, put in bottomland forests, you know, that does a tremendous amount in terms of nitrogen sequestration. I'd rather see all $20 billion of that dollars go into whatever you can to at least hold the line with wetlands and bottomland forests, or do whatever you can to kind of keep Louisiana wild. I prefer not to see it used to build convention centers and things like that.
Well, I'm with you on that. And I just want to thank you so much for taking some time out of finishing that book. When do you expect to see it in print?
I'm hoping 2014, but, you know, one has endless struggles with one's editors and production schedules and so forth. So fingers crossed for spring or summer 2014, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was a little further down the line. But hopefully people will still be reading books by that point.
Okay, well, as soon as I get it in my hands, we're going to have another conversation on Louisiana Eats, if not sooner. Okay, Paul?
Please do.
New York author and writer Paul Greenberg.
Singing to an ocean, I can hear the ocean's roar. Pay for free, I pay for.
Legend has it that a Chicago native named Jimmy Sutro invented Pascal's Minnelli, famous barbecued shrimp. Jimmy loved to play the horses, but when he wasn't at the track, he was hanging out in the kitchen of the famous Napoleon Avenue restaurant with its proprietor, Pascal Rodosta Sr. And that is how the original Pascal's Minnelli barbecued shrimp got cooked up one night. Although Minnelli's has kept their recipe a secret, it's said to be nothing more than margarine, salt, and black pepper with shrimp baked in a convection oven. If you'd like to give barbecued shrimp a try in your own kitchen, here's a couple of quick and easy pointers. My first suggestion, size does matter. When purchasing shrimp, make sure to get the big ones, 16 to 20 per pound. And margarine? I use butter instead of margarine, and I can't resist adding fresh lemon peel, lemon juice, garlic, and a combination of cayenne, white, and freshly cracked black pepper. I melt the butter, add the rest of the ingredients, and then pour it over the shrimp, allowing them to marinate in the refrigerator for several hours. Then I use the broiler in my oven to cook the shrimp, stirring frequently until they're just starting to turn a toasty brown. This super fast dinner is ready in less than 15 minutes. Don't forget that hot French bread to soak up every bit of buttery deliciousness. You can find lots of different barbecued shrimp recipes around. Some of them add beer, some add cream, but please, no herbs. Rosemary, thyme, and bay belong in Shrimp Mosca, not Minnelli's barbecued shrimp. For the full recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Alex Miller is the staff economist for the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission, a quasi-governmental group established by Congress with the purpose of promoting and protecting the Gulf fisheries. Alex is also the program manager for Gulf Seafood Trace. Joining us in our conversation is Melinda Kelly, the project manager for GCR, Inc., the consulting firm responsible for Gulf Seafood Trace's outreach, enrollment, and overall communication strategy and execution. Whew, that's a mouthful. Alex and Melinda, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Well, it's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Alex, explain why and how the Gulf Seafood Trace program was initiated.
Well, this came from a congressional appropriation, and the intent of Congress was to try to better place Gulf seafood in the market. And the real intent was to move forward with different types of marketing activities, traceability activities, sustainability, and some seafood testing. So within all that, we created this traceability effort to do those things, to better market it and hopefully increase demand and the price for Gulf seafood.
The program that you created has an electronic traceability platform. Can you translate that part into layman's terms? How does that work?
Right. The electronic traceability platform really connects the boat to the plate. And it starts at the boat and at the dock with this electronic trip ticket system that feeds the electronic traceability platform, where different businesses in the marketplace or in the supply chain can put different types of information in there, so the different players or the different participants in the marketplace can access that information. Everybody from the processor to the distributor to ultimately the consumer, the retailer, the restaurant.
So everybody's hands that this is passing through, from the fisherman's hands to the dock to the processor to ultimately the chef, all the fingerprints are very clear in this, right?
Right, absolutely. They can all put in different types of information and access information to do a whole variety of different things, better differentiate their product, communicate the quality, communicate a particular certification. So it's really a tool but that empowers these businesses in the marketplace.
And it helps tell the story of the fishermen, too.
Absolutely.
All of this is done, as I understand it, with a quick reference code, which many of us have probably seen and maybe didn't even know what it is. What does that look like, and how does that work?
Well, a quick reference code, otherwise known as a QR code, is sort of this square set of dots that allow a consumer to scan it with their phone to access a particular website. So in a magazine, it might take you to a particular company. But in our case, it connects you to this electronic traceability platform that we were talking about so that they can see where their seafood came from, how it moved through the marketplace, access and learn about the story of the fisherman or the boat or the community, access recipes, tasting notes, you name it. That seafood business can put it on there. You have a lot more space and opportunity to put information there that you don't traditionally have on a package or on a menu or something. So it's a tool. What we're doing here is putting a tool in the hands of the seafood business to help them better position themselves in the market.
Yeah, and it just depends on their business goals, how they want to use that tool. This tool allows them to market themselves better to consumers. It helps with fraud reduction, like you were saying, mislabeling, and it helps with faster recalls because it's electronic.
How's it going as far as the people coming on board with mm-hmm. this project working with you?
We find that it's significant and encouraging because it's a voluntary program. So if you think about it, these businesses are committing to volunteer their time and effort and put it into a tool that they might not see benefits for right away. You know, this might be a long-term solution for their business. They might eventually gain more clients or hopefully get a better price for their product. But in the short term, they're going to have to put in a lot of work to get there. And so 20% of the industry seems pretty significant to us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's your piece of the puzzle, right, Melinda?
Right.
You do the outreach.
Yep.
So, you know, anybody who's ever worked with people in the seafood industry knows they don't get corralled real well.
No, they don't.
How's that project going for you? Describe what your process is like.
So most of my day is spent trying to engage the seafood community, get them interested, educate them on the program, and really finding which businesses would be right for this program. It's not necessarily for everyone, although we wish that everyone would participate. These early adopters that we've found so far are very innovative. They're a lot of your larger processors, so they're equipped to handle this new technology. And what we would like to eventually get to is their docks, their related businesses. You know, we need to start penetrating the market. But I love the outreach to processors. Right now it's going really well. They're very receptive. There's healthy skepticism, as there is with any free governmental program. But we found that overall they're very receptive.
So it's free. There aren't any costs related to the fishermen and the processors?
Right. Until the end of 2014, the Gulf States Marine Fisheries Commission, through this congressional appropriation from the Department of Commerce, covers the cost of this technology. So they're able to try it out and see if this is something they want to keep going with in the future and see if it's right for their business.
Right.
And I imagine the ultimate goal is to be able to translate this into profitability. Are you starting to see that? What sort of results do you have?
Well, that's hard to quantify. We've had a couple of processors indicate that they've picked up a number of different buyers, retailers. But in terms of actual percentage of an increase in the price for Gulf Seafood, that would be hard to really pinpoint and say that's just a result of seafood traceability or by doing these types of things. So we plan to do some surveys later on to try to better understand how the program has helped their business. But that is ultimately the goal, to better position their business in the marketplace and hopefully have some increased returns on investments.
The feedback we've gotten so far is that it has helped them get new business. Mostly it's helped them keep the business they have, which unfortunately is a goal right now for most of these guys. Companies like Whole Foods require this exact traceability software, which our program gives to the industry for free. So a lot of them are able to keep their existing clients like Whole Foods by engaging in this traceability program.
Ultimately, I believe that a large factor in this story is that it really is telling the story of the fishers and crabbers and oystermen who actually harvest our Gulf seafood. And personally, I always feel that food tastes better when it comes to the table and you know the people who are bringing it there. And this is such a rare opportunity for the consumer to get to know the fisherman without ever having to make the trip down to the dock. So could you give us a specific fisherman's tale that perhaps they might be able to find with their smartphone by just using the QR?
Yeah, it's hard to pick just one to choose from. Yeah, but if we could elevate one, it would have to be Mike Wazan and Motivated Seafoods out of Houma. The industry lost Mike, and his participation in our program has been unbelievable. His business is not yet to the point where they're putting QR codes on their bags, but that was an effort that was underway, and I think that they'll get there. And what consumers would find if they were to scan his QR codes is that his business is multi-generational. They have embraced technology for generations. Their oysters are safe. They're very unique in their marketing efforts because they gold band their oysters. They're very easy to shuck. And they're sourced locally. So we're hoping that when end consumers know better, they'll buy better. And when they scan those QR codes, if they see that it is local, they'll want to support people like Mike and his family.
Is there anything new coming down the pike in these efforts that we should be looking for?
So there's some different retail partnerships that are about to be kicked off with a couple of different retailers that you'll be able to, well, they'll be able to have the traceability right there in their hands. So that's something that's new. We have some other opportunities out there with different restaurant associations and those types of things. We haven't done too much on the food service side, but we're looking to move into that area.
And that's really the next phase of the program. This first year, our focus was on establishing engagement with the processors and getting people signed up. Well, now that we have a significant number of the industry signed up, we need to push that information out to the consumers. And that's what we're poised to do in 2013.
Well, this is so much fascinating information. Just in time for our biggest seafood eating time down here in Louisiana. So thank you so much for coming to see us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Melinda Kelly and Alex Miller of the Gulf Seafood Trace Program.
I run the fish house, get my fish down by the sea.
We'll be back from the next short break with a colorful character, so renowned for his seafood purveying business that he's known as Shrimp Daddy. Stay tuned.
You got a new kind of fish. It sure do taste good to me.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's heroes are no strangers to adversity. First, Hurricane Katrina decimated their lives. During the storm, their shrimp boat sunk, and they lost their home and seafood store in St. Bernard Parish. While rebuilding their lives, our brave heroes were forced to live in a two-bedroom apartment with their four children. They raised the shrimp boat from its watery grave and had the engines rebuilt so they could harvest Louisiana's vital shrimp crop once again. When the Crescent City Farmers Market reopened in November of 2005, our culinary heroes were there with a truck full of shrimp ready for hungry market shoppers. Their determination allowed Louisiana families to serve fresh shrimp in their traditional recipes on the first Thanksgiving after the storm. But as things began to look better for our heroes, fate dealt them another devastating blow. Our shrimper hero was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, and the doctors gave him very little hope for the future. With determination, prayers, and perseverance, our hero bravely faced every treatment that could possibly make a difference in his life. His cancer has now been in remission for more than 2 years. Today, his wife can still be happily found at the Crescent City Farmers Market every Tuesday and Saturday, weighing out beautiful just-caught shrimp for their devoted customers. That's why this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Heroes, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, are the very deserving husband and wife team, Ray and Kay Brandhurst. Congratulations, Ray and Kay, and thank you for making sure that one of our favorite Louisiana eats is fresh from the water and ready for the pot. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Louisiana's most important crops is harvested annually from the water, not the land. In 2012, Louisiana's harvest totaled over 49.6 million pounds of the sweet, delicious crustacean we all love, shrimp. Louis Raines has been part of the seafood scene here since 1990. Along the way, he's earned the name Shrimp Daddy. Louis, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like you to take us back to the start of your business and tell us how exactly you became Shrimp Daddy.
You know, it's even further back than 20 years. I mean, I've been fishing and hunting and that sort of thing all of my life. And I was just kind of around the seafood industry. My family is from Poydras area, and we have property in Delacroix. So I used to go down and go crabbing and shrimping and fishing and all that sort of thing. And I just got this idea that I wanted to kind of be in the seafood business. Nobody really steered me to it. I just kind of came up with this idea. So went down to the docks and bought some shrimp, and I started peddling them on the street to just some family and friends. And then it kind of blossomed.
So you were making home deliveries.
Home deliveries. That's how I started, yes.
And then what happened?
Well, I was doing that for a number of years, and I was able to make a living doing that. And then some of my customers kind of drug me into some of the restaurants, and I didn't want to do that. I was really happy with what I was doing, and I was able to go fishing and have a pretty good life. Well, anyway, I started doing the restaurants, and then I just never really went back.
Have you been dealing with the same shrimpers, some of them, all this time?
Yes. A lot of the guys that I first started dealing with passed away. I mean, they were older trawlers and that sort of thing. But there's been a big transition over the last 20 years. I mean, our fleet went, it just changed. I mean, I would say the majority of the big boats in Louisiana are Vietnamese-owned now.
Yeah. What do you see as being the issue with why we're losing our shrimp fleets?
It's a lot of real hard work, and people, I'm not going to say, you know, most people, but a lot of people just really don't want to work that hard. Okay, and that's going to probably be the first thing.
It's a generational thing. Right. Often the next generation, they don't want to work that hard.
No, I mean, you have to really kind of get into it when you're really young and just kind of love it. Mm-hmm. You either love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
There's no, you know, in between. It's not just the hard work. The second aspect of it is the estuaries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know you talk about it a lot, but we have lost, you know, over one football field of land every 15 or 20 minutes to the Gulf. So basically, there's not a whole lot of land left between Grand Isle and Lafitte anymore.
Yeah, Delacroix hardly exists at all.
Exactly. And if you ride down there, it's just heartbreaking to see all those old oak trees dead because of the saltwater intrusion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's mind-boggling what the federal government has allowed to happen to this state. So without the little estuaries and the little duck ponds and the land for the shrimp to come in and kind of lay their eggs in kind of a safe environment where, let's say, a shrimp lays a billion eggs, maybe the percentage of maybe 6 or 7% survival rate, now that it's just kind of open water, survival rate's going to go down even less to maybe 1%.
Because they needed all of those little nooks and crannies for nurseries.
Nurseries, exactly. And also they would feed off of all of the grass and all the different things that were floating around in the water.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, you know, probably grow about a half a size per week. So that is probably one of the biggest things that have hurt the shrimping industry.
Mm-hmm.
The price of fuel, the cost to put the boat together and that sort of thing has hurt a lot. And, of course, the foreign imports. You know, those guys are just kind of raping and pillaging rainforests and just digging shrimp ponds and contaminating the land and then moving on to the next project. And those shrimp farms have been probably the most detrimental thing to happen to the planet.
I agree. What do you see that shrimpers are doing now to help survive in the business?
Well, that's a really good question. The biggest thing that I've seen the shrimpers do is they don't go out and speculate anymore. They don't just like go out for a week at a time, load up the boat and just kind of fuel it up and go see what's going to happen. They just kind of work the moons and the tide tables. Like say you have a full moon and then that means that the tide's going to be coming and going faster at that moment. So they're going to probably work 3 days before the moon, and then 3 days afterwards. So they won't expend a lot of fuel. They can just kind of sit there in one spot, anchored, let the tide just kind of go through their nets. And that's pretty much that's what they all say. We just don't speculate anymore.
You know, I find that to be one of the very interesting things about the perception of our shrimp business and the reality of the shrimp business. Because there are a lot of people across the country who believe that shrimp trawls are ruining the environment. But exactly the way you described the lazy way that you can shrimp in Louisiana without expending fuel, you're also not fooling with the bottom or doing anything wrong for the environment, correct?
That is correct. I mean, a shrimper is nothing more than a farmer. And his plow is his boat with his net. And he goes back and forth, up and down, back and forth, up and down. It's very hard work and boring, and there's a lot of labor involved. But it is what it is. You know, a lot of these guys, they're struggling, and they have to actually have full-time jobs. So, again, they just kind of go out on the weekends, or they'll take a few days off in the middle of the week when they know the shrimp are going to be running. And that's how they have adapted to the cards that they've been dealt with.
Well, tell me about the different varieties in shrimp that we will see here in Louisiana seasonally and how they differ.
Well, there's a little book I read, and I can't really remember the title, but it was something like a short story, and where the brown shrimp would come in at the beginning of the year, and they would lay their eggs, and then they would stay for a certain amount of time, and then the tide would take them back out to the Gulf again. And then the brown shrimp would grow a half a size per week, and then, you know, most of them would get caught, but a big percentage of them wouldn't, and then they would go back out into the Gulf and do the cycle again next year.
Mm-hmm.
And then the white shrimp come in, you know, just like clockwork. Same situation as the brown shrimp come in, lay their eggs, and then just kind of go back out into the Gulf again.
What's the difference in the taste?
Well, you know, I like them both, okay?
Yeah. I'm not going to turn down either one either.
No. But, you know, the white shrimp, you know, you get bigger shrimp like 10 15s and 16 20s, and those are the ones that are more desirable around here.
And of course, that's count per pound.
Right, count
per
pound.
Yeah, so 10 shrimp per pound, that's a monster shrimp.
It really is. But the brown shrimp is the majority of the shrimp, and those are the ones that you eat on your po' boys, you know.
And in your gumbo, I think there's nothing like brown shrimp in gumbo.
Absolutely. I agree. I mean, brown shrimp, especially the inside waters.
Yes.
And those are the shrimp that our people around here, those are the ones that they ask their shrimp guy, whoever it is, to bring to them for their restaurants and then take the other stuff and just kind of ship it out to somebody else.
Yeah, and that's the springtime shrimp, and they're sweet.
They're sweet,
just like sugar.
Yep.
I'm curious to hear your opinion about this. I personally feel that I would rather have an IQF shrimp, an individually quick frozen shrimp, rather than buying a fresh shrimp that I cannot be guaranteed is perhaps less than 72 hours out of the water. How do you feel about that?
I agree with you. There are a lot of people out there in the business, you know, that just kind of take an IQF shrimp and just thaw them out and pass them off as fresh shrimp all day long.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that they should be doing, but it does.
They do that.
So if you take the IQF shrimp and they IQF it right on the boat, then they've basically just stopped the process of it decomposing, you know, the shelf life. You know, they could keep it 5 or 6, 7, 8 months in that condition, and you could thaw it out, and it'll be almost as good as the shrimp that just came off the boat 72 hours, as you said.
And how about storing shrimp? How long will shrimp stay fresh, do you think? And do you have any suggestions for home cooks about how to treat them?
Let's say you get a cooler of shrimp, you know, and you want to hold them for a couple days. I mean, you can keep them in an ice water slushy environment for probably 7 days without really losing, you know, any of the quality, really. The head will start falling off and maybe kind of turning a blackish color.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not any – there's nothing wrong with that. There's just some sort of a – when it meets the air, something happens to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the quality, you know, is still there. It just doesn't look that pretty.
It's that slushy water that's really the trick.
Right. If you have shrimp that just came in from the boat 1 day old, they can't even peel those shrimp because they're too fresh. Just the shell won't release.
Yeah.
They have to let it sit 2 or 3 days before they can even peel them.
Yeah. Well, I was fascinated to learn that you have a satellite shrimp daddy business in the Denver Boulder area. How'd that come about?
Well, it's that old thing called Katrina.
Oh, my.
Yep. I mean, we evacuated... just worked our way up to Colorado, you know. There was nothing else to do, so we just took a ride up there and just kind of hung out there and really loved it a lot. And I found a lot of New Orleans up there, you know, people that have been there even before Katrina. And I don't know what the connection is, but there's a big connection between New Orleans and Colorado. So me being me, I just started to kind of open up a market and started selling people things up there. I was just kind of running my business remotely. And you know how that goes. That
yeah.
did work out very well.
Not for long.
No, so I'm back now.
But you still have customers in Colorado.
Yes, like I'm going up in May to do a big crawfish boil for a guy that has like 7 restaurants up there.
Oh, what fun. Well, I'm very curious about the differences in expectations from your Colorado customers versus your Louisiana clients. How do their expectations differ?
Well, they're equally... excited, okay, let's say. I mean, I did a few boils up there and parties and stuff at the house, and I boiled shrimp and crawfish and potatoes and corn, all the good stuff. And it was just weird. I had about 20 people come over, and I almost had as much food left when they left as when they came. And that's the only knock that I have about Colorado. Everyone's really cool, but the natives are really cool. There aren't many of them. And then these people that are coming from other places, I miss the culture.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for helping me debunk a lot of the mysteries and the myths about the shrimp business. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Louis Rains, Louisiana's own Shrimp Daddy.
The shrimp folks is a calling, their sails are inside. Shrimp folks is a calling, there's dancing tonight. Why don't you hurry, hurry, hurry home? Why don't you hurry, hurry, hurry home?
Look here, the shrimp folks is a calling, there's dancing tonight.
Shrimp folks is a calling, there's dancing, there's dancing, there's dancing, there's dancing. Shrimp folks is a calling tonight.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Lightsegan and Westside Lightsegan Funeral Homes, LCI Workers' Comp, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.